Everyone, thank you for tuning into the Postmodern Realities podcast from the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. You're listening to episode 13 of Postmodern Realities, and I'm Melanie Cogdill, managing editor of the Christian Research Journal. On this episode, I'm joined by Jay Watts, who is vice president of Life Training Institute. Jay speaks at universities, high schools, and churches across the United States. And he participates in numerous radio and television interviews on the subject of the value of human life. On equip.org, the website of the Christian Research Institute, Jay has written a film review called Me Before You's Strange View of Love and Weak Defense of Assisted Suicide, which evaluates the June 2016 film Me Before You, which is based on the best-selling novel of the same name by JoJo Moyes. In addition, Jay has written an article on assisted suicide called Death with Dignity and the Imago Dei, which was published in the Christian Research Journal last year. Jay, it's good to have you on.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Well, I also went to see this film, Me Before You, and it's been characterized as a romantic chick flick. And so in regards to doing a more philosophically focused review of the film, how do you answer the criticism that this is just a lightweight movie? In other words, why should we take it seriously?
Yeah, and I have heard that from several people who have contacted me and said, why do you care about a movie? Well, it's interesting because film, and then prior to that, literature, art, music, all of these things have always had a profound influence on us as a culture, on all cultures. I think last week I was playing a trivia game with someone, and the question came up, what was the best-selling novel of the 19th century? And I was surprised that nobody said Harriet Beecher Stowe's Uncle Tom's Cabin, with a wild influence that it had on the pre-Civil War of the United States and changing the way that people viewed slavery. But they don't connect novels immediately to the great events of that century. So it has always been the case that we are influenced by the art. We influence art, and then art influences us back. We are whole human beings. And I would even argue more importantly today than in the past, people are less swayed oftentimes by intellectual arguments and reasoned arguments as a whole, and they're more influenced by emotional appeals. And so the emotional appeal of a movie is something worth considering and worth addressing. If you don't answer it, then there's nothing out there oftentimes but bad philosophy. We have a responsibility to answer that and to draw attention to that for those people that will be swayed by reasons.
Well, this movie is kind of a romantic love story, and it involves one of the main characters, Will Traynor, who is disabled. He is disabled in a motorcycle accident. He walks in front of a motorcycle that hits him in the book and in the movie. And I've seen some objections by critics of the film who are disabled, but they do also say that the film represents something that's true. So there are disabled people out there who feel like this main character, Will Traynor, is like them. And these people ask why one group of disabled people get to delegitimize the honest feelings of another group of disabled people. So how do you respond to that?
And a woman by the name of Dovey Eisner has written a great piece that's at the Federalist where she defends the idea that this represents real things that she has gone through as a disabled individual. And so there is a view out there of people that say, look, this is real. This is something that people go through. How can you try to shut it down in dialogue? The vast majority, though, of disabled critics that I have read have responded that the problem isn't in allowing someone the artistic freedom to express a story that they want to express, to tell a story that they want to tell. They have no problem with that. What they're responding to is a pattern of the use of disability as an excuse for this particular story that seems to be showing up over and over and over again. They said there is no other voice. The view is predominantly a pro-euthanasia, pro-physician-assisted suicide view without balance. The two biggest examples of that would be Million Dollar Baby years ago and Me Before You Now, but there's many others between there that have been brought up by several of the disabled advocates. And what they're saying is, nowhere in this dialogue are we seeing any representation of another view. One of the criticisms by a guy by the name of William Peace, who is a disabled scholar, said, Moyes, in writing the book, acknowledges she never even talked to a quadriplegic. She never talked to anybody who is going through this or living with this. all we see is this idea that it is the one thing that cannot be overcome. I've even saw a couple of them referencing Million Dollar Baby, and they said, we had this story of this woman, this character Maggie, who would overcome so many things during the course of the story. She was the very picture of the person who overcomes her circumstances. And then at the end of the movie, we're seeing this is the one thing that cannot be overcome. And what they're saying is this is a message that is the dominant message delivered by Hollywood. There seems to be no interest in balancing it out, representing alternative views, of letting this be an area where it can be overcome and an issue of hope. And for those people, they say, we're being taught a lesson that this is the right way to respond to this scenario, that this is just a bleak, hopeless situation that you get into, and that you end up with this moment of heroism where this person finally sacrifices their life or somebody helps them to die. They said if we were seeing it in balance with a great number of other stories, that would be one thing. But it is the only story coming out, and because of that, they feel a danger being represented in that message.
Well, I heard an interview about the film with the author, and she was saying the reason why she wrote the book in the first place, and then she also wrote the screenplay to the film, is that she really wanted to represent walking in the shoes of someone who is disabled. So she was saying you can't really know why someone would choose this. You can't judge them because you haven't really felt how they've felt. And so how do you, it's really an emotional appeal, I think. How do you respond to that? You haven't really felt, she made up this character, Will Traynor, because maybe we can't know how he really felt, like he was feeling so meaningless unless he could, in fact, take his life.
Yeah, and then, you know what? That was there was a point where I was going to include that in my review of the film, but I took it back because he talks about that power that he, the last bit of power that he has. And there, that is philosophically reminiscent of something you hear argued by existentialists like Camus as he sorts through that in The Myth of Sisyphus. And it goes back even to what Camus talks about, a character called Kirillov in Dostoevsky, this idea that there is a strength, a power left that I have in the face of absurd circumstances, and that's to pull myself out of them. I really think that that in and of itself is a dangerous appeal to a philosophical background that isn't hashed out for people, because what we hear, especially from disability advocates, is what we would appreciate is the recognition that there is a period that immediately happens when somebody goes through this, and then oftentimes recurring, coming and going. But these are emotional states that can be overcome, and that they need help. Certainly they need help from other people to overcome these emotional conditions, these emotional states. But to begin to see that there is life, that there are other aspects of their life that have value, that are carrying on at the loss of these other things. And that's what I've seen several disability advocates point to, the constant reference back to what I lost versus what I have today, versus an affirmation of the new life that I have and the new way of enjoying these things that I'm able to find, that people that live with this daily and have full, prosperous, abundantly joyful lives are expressing and seeing. It's not the same life. There's always going to be something that was lost that can never be retrieved, but there's no message of hope of a new life and new joys. And so that's one of the things that I think really seems to be at central to the criticism of this.
So why do you think the Right to Die movement has gained so much political traction in the United States? In your article that we published last winter, you know, you talked about Brittany Maynard. I mean, she was all over the news. She was on the cover of People, just about how she was going to end her life because of her diagnosis and so forth. So it's really kind of taken more of a focus, a center stage focus in our culture. Why do you think that that's happening right now?
Well, and I think where you go back is you see this series of events where people are emotionally charged by issues. Go back before Brittany Maynard, go all the way back to 1970s with Karen Ann Quinlan, follow that up with the woman who was in a persistent vegetative state, however much I hate that, but that was her diagnosis. I hate that term. From a car wreck and a car accident, there was a fight over her right to be removed from a respirator. And when they removed her from the respirator, she continued to live for another 10 years and ultimately died. Nancy Kruse in the 1990s, Terri Schiavo in the early 2000s. And then you have Brittany Maynard in the 2014-2015 time period. You have these stories, and we are, again, as a very influenced by emotion, these emotional stories that we can feel deep empathy for, and that they attach to as a need to address this situation, this idea that we ought to be able to help these people or to do something about this issue. And I really think that's what has fed this growing movement in the United States. It's not a universal problem where it's happening all of the time, but because information comes so quickly to us and we access it too, we're able to become deeply emotionally entrenched in these stories that are the exceptions, that Leon Cass would talk about these ethical issues that are unique almost, but that really push us to our ethical considerations. And he says all ethical worldviews have to deal with this. We have to deal with these edge issues that push us to the very edge of how we're going to sort these things out. But these edge issues are so front and center in our news stories because they're so compelling and they have such emotional tie to us that, and you have this constant chain of them happening that keeps drawing us back into the story. How do we have an empathetic response or sympathetic response to this? And for a culture that is largely emotionally driven, we immediately look to change laws and immediately look to rectify what we see as wrong without real deep consideration about what the end result of those laws will be.
You're listening to the Postmodern Realities Podcast from the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. Today's guest is Jay Watts, who has written a film review available free online at equip.org called Me Before You's Strange View of Love and Weak Defense of Assisted Suicide, which evaluates the June 2016 film Me Before You. We were just talking about just feeling empathy, you know, like how we see all these different stories in the culture and how we feel empathy with people facing this terminal diagnosis that they have. And I also recently in town in Charlotte, Diane Rehm came, who's a radio talk show host who's written a memoir about her husband and how she strongly believes in the right to die, given his end suffering before he died and so forth. And so what is wrong with the right to die? I mean, why can't people make this choice for themselves? I mean, she was very adamant, Diane Rehm was, when I was listening to her interview about how she just really feels that people need to choose the time and manner in which they die, especially if they have just complete suffering over some kind of health diagnosis.
And Diane Rehm's husband ceased to take nourishment himself. He made the decision to not do it. So her emotion over this issue, her deep passion over this issue, was bought through that process of watching her husband decide for himself, I am done, and the refusal to take care anymore. I think that first we have to differentiate between what we do have a right to do. The idea that, and that's where I think we get into a lot of problems, is we have, first, there's a right to refuse medical treatment. This came in 1991. The U.S. Congress passed the Patient Self-Determination Act, largely in response to cases like Karen Ann Quinlan and Nancy Cruson. The idea was that we were allowed to say enough is enough. In this culture where medical progress was driving us to this place where people were surviving much longer in conditions that they did not want to survive in, there had to be the right of the patient to say, I refuse to take these extreme medical steps to keep myself alive, and I want to allow myself to go through the natural process of dying. We all die. It's the end of life for each and every one of us. It is appointed to all men to die once, as we're told through Scripture. And so we have this natural process that we're going through, that we're interrupting it sometimes in extreme ways. And so we have a right, I believe, a right to refuse medical treatment. I don't think it's universal. I mean, I think that there are reasonable restraints on it, but there is a right there to say, look, I no longer want you to do all of these things to keep me alive. I choose to allow this process to end with my death. The right to die is a different thing because it brings in the entire society into it. When I say I have the right to refuse medical treatment, I'm saying that I have the right to stop the advancement of medicine and keeping me alive, sometimes unnaturally. And that's where you get the need for people to have these written consents to what they would do if they were incapacitated, what they would want as far as the medical treatment, how they would want to be treated. When you get to a right to die, you're starting to do something that includes everybody in it. It's starting to draw in all of society. It puts obligations on other people.
So in both your movie review and the article that I talked about that you wrote on this issue, you talk about embracing these laws that they could dangerously encourage a felt duty to die in our culture. I mean, it seems like that we would want to embrace, I mean, our culture wants to embrace this. Is there any evidence that this is really a concern, or is this just a slippery slope? So if we keep, you know, encouraging this, this eventually will have laws in all 50 states or something like that.
Well, you know, what you have is the warning there is the idea that we're building in people a duty to die. The idea that they feel the need to hasten their death to lessen the burden on the people around them. Thinking about what the terrible thing that Diane Rehm had to go through. And in addressing all of these issues, nobody says that these aren't terrible things. We're trying to find the best way to do things that recognizes the importance of individual life and our responsibility not to draw the entire society up into a process that obligates us to participate in the chosen death of anybody who wishes to die for a particular reason. So when we're talking about this duty to die, first of all, I think it's not something that's unheard of in history. As a matter of fact, if you read Frank Beckwith and Greg Kokel's book, Relativism, Feet Firmly Planted in Midair, they discuss a 16th century Hudson Bay Native American tribe that used to strangle their elderly parents to death once they reached a certain point. Now, this wasn't seen as a bad thing within this culture. It was actually seen as a good thing. These elderly people had reached a point where they could no longer contribute in the way they wanted to contribute, and so it was a point of honor for them to sacrifice themselves for the tribe. So cultures, the ethics, the overall approach to death in a culture, these ideas do communicate all the way through and are felt. I've talked to several hospice nurses in the last year since I first set out to write that article for CRJ. I sat down with them and said, this is one of the arguments that's offered. Do you see in the patients that you work with in hospice care a duty to die? And all of them, every single one of them, 100% of the nurses that I talked to affirmed that that was there, that these people felt as if their death, the last days of their lives, the last moments that they had with their loved ones was a burden on the world around them, and that they needed to hasten this in some way, this desire for it to be over so they could release that burden. And Ira Byock, who is really the father of the modern hospice movement, who's written a couple of books, one of them called Dying Well, he relates in that the story of trying to convince his own father that his death was not a burden on his family, where he was begging his father during the last days of his father's life to allow him the privilege of taking care of him. He was saying, look, I want to be there with you. I want to be the person that's with you and allows this time to be the last days that we spend together loving each other as a family, and not for it to degenerate into you feeling as if you need to go away and cut yourself off and hospitalize yourself and die in some sterile medical environment away from all the people that you care and that you care for and that you love. And so it is, since if I take their testimony as being reflective of the truth, which I assume it is, these people had no reason to lie to me, and most of them had varying views on some of the views that I had, but they all universally said, in all the patients they deal with, there is a sense towards the end that they are becoming a burden on the world around them. And the more we communicate that with them, making these heroic stories of people who choose to end their life early, the more that message comes through loud and clear. The best thing that you can do for society is hasten your death. It is a burden. You are right. And all of the worst things that you feel, and what should be really one of the great moments of your life, that time of reflection, that time to be able to wrap it up, that time to be there and have your family love you. We as a society have turned it into something that's hospitalized, that has become commercialized in many ways, that is dictated by insurance. We just don't die well in the United States. And as a result, that felt duty to die, as near as I can tell from talking to people that deal with it every day, it is a real thing.
You know, what's interesting, kind of on the flip side, is I was reading an op-ed by a physician a few months ago in the New York Times, and it was interesting. His father, who had also been a physician, was very supportive of right to die. Like, you should not extend anyone's life, until he got Parkinson's. And then towards the end of his life, he was saying that he wanted to extend his life. But when his mind started going, his own son, who that felt like what my dad is saying now is not reflective of who he was when he was, you know, was more lucid. And so therefore he didn't honor his dad's wishes. I thought that was really fascinating, because he went back to, well, what my dad wanted to do, who was a physician when he was practicing medicine. It's not what I hear him saying now that he's ill. So I want to honor what he did, what he thought when he was well. So that's kind of the flip side of his father did want to stay. And I think he ended up not honoring his father's wishes at the end. That was very fascinating. But how do you respond to the claims by right to die supporters that say, you know, these kinds of laws are meant to prevent, you know, kind of extreme excesses, like, you know, Dr. Jack Kevorkian, what he did in the 1990s, or maybe some of the more liberally applied right to die laws in Europe, like in Belgium and Switzerland, for example?
Yeah, and Barbara Coombs Lee, who is the head of the Death with Dignity movement, really the she does most speaking on that in our cult, in our country. She makes that exact case. She says she recognizes that there are abuses, and that she says the laws that we're passing specifically here in the United States are meant to be laws that protect us from those abuses. I think that there's two things that we can look at that undermine that argument in the long run. Number one would be what happened in the Netherlands, the process of how the laws degenerated very quickly. But the reason that they started changing in the laws in the Netherlands was often because you had this ethic, this culture, this moral sensibility going back to the 19th century that physician-assisted suicide and euthanasia were wrong. And then in the 70s, there was a doctor who gave a lethal injection to her terminally ill mother who was convicted, but her sentence was suspended because the court said when you have a terminally ill patient, there is a moral opening, a reasonable response is to provide them their death if that's what they want. And then what happened for years was that doctors started practicing this even though it was still illegal, and the government sort of turned their head. And so finally in 2001, after a long process, they made everything legal because they said, look, it's happening anyway. And then by 2004, they made the same reaction with the Groningen Protocol, where they decide we're going to set standards for euthanizing newborns and for standards for infanticide because it's happening anyway. The doctors are already doing it. In any place where the ethic or the morality changes, laws inform morality, and then laws change to fit that new cultural ethic. And so we have no pattern that we can look at where we can see there was a place where they put in a more permissive attitude, a more permissive ethic, a more permissive moral code and laws allowing physician-assisted suicide where it stopped there. What happens is that people start to argue about those standards. Like in the United States, it's you have to have terminally ill patient that is going to have suffering and it's going to be imminent. The death is within the next 6 months, and two doctors verify that, and that the patient is within their mental capacities to make this decision. But the problem then becomes, well, why 6 months instead of eight? And what constitutes suffering? Why is their suffering worse than mine? And these are the arguments that we saw happen in Europe all the way up into the point where at Dignitas, the place that's represented in the movie Me Before You, they actually have euthanized or offered suicide services to people who are completely healthy, but they were related to somebody who was terminally ill that no longer wanted to live. And so they all committed suicide together there under the protection of Dignitas, what they call accompanied suicide as one of their services. And you see bioethicists like Jacob Appel back in 2009 already arguing for those liberalization of laws here in the United States, because he said once we've embraced the idea that autonomy is rules, that the idea of choosing for yourself is the most important thing, now the question is, why do you have the right to tell anybody that they can't die? They should all be allowed to choose it for any reason. Who are we to dictate that for them? And so I understand if those stated goals can be accepted as true, we have no pattern of ever seeing it work.
So if these European laws, like you were just saying, have led to these extreme outcomes, why do people still vote for them? Why are they so popularly supported, for example, in Switzerland? You know, if it is extreme, why would people continue to say, yes, let's continue to have these laws?
Yeah, you know, I think that's a great question. And I think there's two things, because it is they have the opportunity to get rid of these laws on several different occasions, and they keep affirming them in overwhelming majorities, even as the government struggles with what they call suicide tourism and trying to find ways to curtail foreigners coming to their country to make use of these assisted suicide laws. And the governments are trying to find some way to do it. They keep going back to the people and saying, will you place restrictions on this now? And there seems to be no level to which they will. I think that one of the answers that on reflection has to be is that we all see people in a certain condition, other human beings in a certain condition, and we make the determination, I would never want to live like that. And I think this goes back to what you said earlier about that case with the father and the son, where when he got Parkinson's, when he was actually in that, there was a change of heart. You know, but looking at it from the outside, there's a sense of, I would never want to be in that position. But the people making that determination are obviously not, as a majority, in that position at that time. So the representative dangers of those laws aren't felt by them. If you're not the victim class, you're very rarely going to feel the fear of victimization. If you're not the target, you're never going to feel the concern that the shots are being fired in your general direction. And so I think that's one of the things. There's a deep and abiding empathy there. I would never want to be in that situation. I understand every horrible thing that person is feeling given that condition. And so I don't want to take away from them the freedom to make that choice. But we're always making that determination in mass as a population when we're not the people that are going to be most directly affected by that, and where abuses of that still aren't going to touch us, or at least not obviously touch us. And so I think that that is one of them. And I think the other one is just a principle of autonomy that's gone wildly out of control. Many times, and now today in our culture, the only ethical consideration that is offered up is autonomy. I get to make choices about what I do with my body, as if other things like non-malfeasance, beneficence, justice, all these other considerations that have routinely been a part of our ethical deliberations don't even exist. All we want to say is if that person makes that decision, they should be allowed to make that decision, no matter how it affects everybody else. And so we end up trying to codify and legalize all of these desires for excesses, these personal things that we wish to have the law to be able to make okay for us and everybody to make it legitimate for us, as opposed to considering on the broad sense, what is this going to do for society and what does this mean for all of us? And is this the best course of action? Which, like I said, Ira Byock, who works in it, says, why don't we just treat their depression as opposed to humoring it and killing them?
So finally, I have two questions for you. So how can, like, practical questions. So first of all, how can Christians offer a compassionate response to our culture on this issue? And secondly, how can Christians deal with it personally? Like, what if they are in a state that allows assisted suicide or has right to die laws, and someone that they love in their immediate family is going through extreme suffering through some kind of terminal illness and is asking, please help me end my life? I mean, how should Christians respond more generally to the cultural and then also personally if they're faced with that decision?
I think number one, I think the answer to the first part is becoming more aware of the hospice movement in the United States to advocate for this idea of opening up the ability for people to make use of hospice, to advocate for the idea of insurance paying for hospice prior to it, this idea of going into a place where we're now going to attend to your comfort, to your needs, to your whole being, your spirituality, but not necessarily fight for every second for the end of your life. We just went through this recently with a relative where I was encouraging my family early on, my wife's family, I know that people have gotten the idea that hospice is giving up. There's a sense that if I go into hospice, it means I am accepting that death is imminent and that it's the end. Because that's the way our culture has decided to use this hospice movement that's out there. But that's not necessarily the case. What they're trying to do is to attend to all of these things, the pain, the perceived indignities, the separation from family, the idea of being in this hospital environment. They're trying to attend all of those. So as a culture, looking to that and saying, what are the successes of the hospice movement? How are they dealing with depression? How are they making the end of life a restorative moment as opposed to a nightmare that everybody's afraid of, especially given these extreme conditions? That's one thing. And I think as far as the other, we always have to plan things out. I think one of the major problems we have in the church and as a Christian body is that we're very reactive. We wait until things are well downstream before we start to say, maybe we should have thought about that before. Now, I understand there's only so much work you can do in the church during the course of a given week, especially if you're a pastor or on ministerial staff, but we need to take seriously the responsibility to make these kind of things a part of our deliberate ethical considerations at church. To me and my family and the people that I've worked with, and I have talked to several people that have been going through this personally with family, what I always try to impress upon them is that the more you work to address the way you think you want things handled before you get to a place, or the way you what you think is right before the emotions are bearing down on you and the fear is bearing down on you, the better chance you have at navigating this well. You have to think about it before we get there, and then when we get there, we have to do everything that we can to consider something other than just a raw emotion of the moment. Can I help in some way that doesn't mean giving into the worst ideas about what this person has about the end of their life? Is there an option where we can help attend to their depression and their fear while we attend to their medical needs?
Well, this was a very sobering conversation, so I want to end it with some lighthearted, fun, rapid-fire questions for Jay. So, Jay, sweet tea or Coca-Cola?
Coca-Cola. I'm drinking one right now.
Are you a spontaneous person or highly scheduled?
I am very spontaneous.
What's your favorite season of the year and why?
Winter, because I love winter clothes. I enjoy cold weather clothes, and you know, I live in Georgia, so it's summer for three seasons and then winter.
So name a book on your summer reading list.
wow, I've got this huge stack of books I was just pulling out right now at home. Man, that's a tough one because I'm trying to sort through in my head all of a sudden. There's a couple that have just recently come out that I'm looking forward to getting into. But probably right now, Columbine, which is a book about what happened at Columbine. I talk a lot recently in talks that I give about how hard it is to know what actually happened in events. And I've read excerpts from Columbine as they're going on. Like right now, as we talk about this, what's happened in Orlando. It's hard to know what actually happened there. And Columbine is a reflection years later, gathering all the evidence about what happened. And I've read excerpts of it, but I really wanted to sit down with it and get a handle just as best I can on that, because it was obviously a truly terrifying thing, but the reality of what happened wasn't actually what people think. So.
And finally, what's something you learned in the last week?
That nonetheless, the word that we kind of run together, nonetheless, is not three separate words, but it's one word, which I've known, but that it's been that way since the 16th century, which I found fascinating. So I was trying to decide whether I'm supposed to write it as three words or as just one. And I read that it's been since like 1533 that we started cramming them all together, and that's just the way it's ever been since. And I just learned that yesterday.
Well, thanks, Jay, for being a guest on the Postmodern Realities podcast.
Thank you so much, Melanie.
Today's guest, Jay Watts, has written a film review available free online at equip.org called Me Before You's Strange View of Love and Weak Defense of Assisted Suicide, which evaluates the June 2016 film Me Before You. To read more articles on Christian ethics, subscribe to the Christian Research Journal. A 6-issue subscription to the journal is $39.50, and to subscribe online, visit equip.org. In the current issue, 39, number 3 of the journal, one of Jay's LTI colleagues has written an article called Why Biologists Tend to Make Bad Ethicists. This article is in a very special issue of the journal, which is only available as a thank you gift for your donation to the ongoing work of the Christian Research Institute. To donate and receive volume 39, number 3, please go to equip.org. Be sure you also tune in daily to the Bible Answer Man broadcast, hosted by CRI President Hank Hanegraaff, who answers your questions live on air. To ask Hank a question, call 888-ASK-HANK at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. To listen to the live stream of the show, as well as previous broadcasts, go to equip.org, where you can also download our free smartphone app, where you can live stream the Bible Answer Man broadcast, listen to previous broadcasts, and subscribe to the Christian Research Journal.